In Souls games, I need to be actively social in the present. I rely on the messages left by others throughout the game. I decide how badly I want to pursue one of the unadorned, obtuse side quests, and check to see if anybody else knows how to do it. All of this is why I'm so often confused by the claim that what people like about Souls games is the difficulty. I can't rely on myself in Bloodborne, or at the very least, it would be incredibly foolish to try and do so. Again and again, I'm relying on the work of others. To be clear, my point isn't just that Dark Souls, or Souls, allows for social activity, it's that the sociality is part of the game. The game doesn't exist on the screen alone, it also exists in our tweets, it exists in the hoops we jump through. It refuses me the idea that I can succeed as an embodied hero. I have to want to succeed not as me, but as an us. That is Reaching Out of the Screen, Games That Play with Immersion, and that is written by my co-host here, Austin Walker.
Like years ago.
Years and years ago.
Before I was anywhere.
But it's very relevant to our topic today.
Right.
Here on Waypoint Radio, of which this is episode 112, and it is Friday, 11/10/17. We have a very special guest.
We
today.
Do.
We have Adam Conover.
Hello.
He's glowing.
Ruins everything. He's not going to ruin this podcast.
No, I'll be
it's
on my
make
best
it better.
Behavior.
He did just pull out a fidget spinner. So
yeah, he did. Yeah.
I have an actual fidget spinner that I.
That's good.
I kickstarted. There was like a guy's Kickstarter, and what's nice about it, it's very small. And so I can carry it in my pocket.
And it's quiet.
It's quiet.
That's
the thing that
anything.
I'm like loving about it.
It's really helpful. Like we're doing some animated records right now for the show, and it's really helpful in the recording booth because I'll have to be in there for 3 hours.
Right.
And I can just sort of be there.
100%.
You know, and it's really helpful. I did this all during Blade Runner, very long movie.
Right.
I was just like, you know, like up at the screen, like
just spinning.
And it actually serves its purpose for me. It actually like
keeps you calm and focused.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to point out that there are spinners in that movie already, but you're
double
adding
spinners.
A new spinner.
Right, the flying car is your spinner.
Like
yes. Real, I'm doing good.
Deeply nerdy joke.
Well, I'm so glad I just did that. I ruined the podcast. Thank you very much.
Danielle ruins everything.
There it is. Yeah. You know, that's the sequel.
That's the Adam ruins everything. Danielle ruins everything.
The reason why I started out with this read of your piece about sort of fairness and difficulty in Souls games is because Adam has some thoughts on that.
Yeah,
I think like you and I were talking.
And you're chatting about it and sort of
what are we
going to
talk
about?
Yes. You were like, I have a story.
Yeah, I have a story. Should I jump into the
story? Let's jump into the story and then we'll wrap
let's
back around
story.
And maybe be like, who are you?
Oh, okay,
actually,
yeah,
let's
sure.
Let's know who are you first. Let's get that out of the
way. Okay.
People who don't know.
Okay, so yeah, my name's Adam. I host a show on True TV called Adam Ruins Everything. It's kind of like an informational sketch comedy show. Yeah. It's like I debunk common misconceptions or tell you the awful truths about things in like the sort of really visual, fast-paced sketch comedy world.
It's good. There's like... It's really cool because like the fundamentals of it is like here is a 6-minute sketch or a 10-minute sketch or whatever that is like going to tell you information.
Yeah.
But you keep the viewer's attention with like little visual gags.
Yeah.
Like the episode that I think I share the most with people is the one on like how did the suburbs come to be?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then like imagine in parentheses it says how did the suburbs become to be incredibly racist?
Yeah.
And like the answer is like redlining, and you go into the history of redlining and you explain the history of redlining through this visual metaphor of like a fake Monopoly style game about like who has access to different pieces on the board and like blah blah blah. And that visual metaphor like really works, especially for an audio for me anyway, right? Which is like, of course, I kind of knew a lot of that stuff already, but like it keeps my attention even though like the data there is kind of droll, like it's kind of dull and boring.
That's one of the sort of challenges we give ourselves on the show because we do a lot of topics that are like on the face of them very exciting to hear about. Like the one that I sort of, you know, made my name with was about how the, you know, diamond engagement ring was a marketing creation by the De Beers cartel, right? Now that's I came up with the whole idea for the show because I would tell people that I put it in my stand-up act and people would just be like, what? Like
right,
their
right,
minds
right.
would
is
be blown.
Yeah,
it was so fun immediately, right? Yeah. But one thing we like to challenge ourselves with is like taking a drier topic or a more difficult topic and making it interesting and fun and intuitive, which is one of the things that visuals help you do. It like helps you get a visual understanding.
That way the listener or the viewer can later just, not the listener if it's a visual thing, the viewer can say like, oh, hey, like 10 months later, they might not remember the exact words that you said, but they'll remember that player couldn't put a piece on the side of the green side of the board, could only put pieces in the red side of the board where there was no wealth and there wasn't access to good schools. Like, okay, that visual metaphor carries very quickly.
Yeah, and that's something we spend a lot of time trying to get just right.
Do you take joy in ruining things?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I if I hated my job, it wouldn't be a career I pursued. Yeah, I really, it's a lot of fun.
things, of course. You, the diamond story reminds me. I used to, when I was doing my PhD in Canada, my friend Eric taught a course on, shout out to Eric Lohman, a course on the wedding industry and like on the bridal industry, and like how the modern notion of weddings were produced and were, you know, marketed and sold, and like how it's this money dump, and also like how the notion of marriage is tied to a historical system of patriarchy, blah 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 blah. And like, of course, like when that listing went into the books for like, oh, it's courses available, it's just like the wedding course. It's just the course about weddings. Mm-hmm. And so he gets lots of young women who sign up who are like excited about weddings and who are exactly the sorts of people who like should take a course on the culture of weddings and wedding culture and the wedding industry.
They're going to be targeted by that industry.
They're going to be targeted. And like, they're like literally targeted.
Yes.
And the response was always like this amazing arc, he said, of like, beginning of the class, everyone's super skeptical. Middle of the class, they fucking hate him because he's doing this thing for me. And then I think maybe this is maybe what the real appeal of the show is for you, is like they bounce back up and are like, okay, well, now I'm an engaged and critical consumer who moves through the world and understands what's happening. And I can still make the decisions I want. I can still subscribe to Bridal Monthly if that's like my thing. But like I know what's happening here.
Exactly.
Right. Well, the thesis of the show, one of our mottos is it's always better to know. Right. That's something I believe, that there's no virtue in ignorance. And you know, the way I think it works is that it's like, it's temporarily uncomfortable to learn the truth, especially if you had some amount of investment, especially if it's your identity was invested in the truth at all, which is what, you know, what makes, you know, any topic having to do with race or class or any sort of like really deeply rooted identity thing people really freak out about. But like it's temporarily uncomfortable. But then at the end, it actually is always fun to learn something.
Right.
Like, and so that's like one of the things that makes me happy to do our show is that like people just genuinely like to learn as a human. It's a universal human desire.
There's like part of your brain that just functions. I mean,
and all we have to do to appeal is to appeal to people, you know, like and they don't, people aren't spoken that way.
Why are things so bad?
Teaching people?
No, why are things so bad? Like if it is true that we like to learn.
Yeah.
Whether that's because we come from cultures of learning or because we have something built in our brain that's like, ah, the lizard brain loves to actually get more information about things, whatever that is. Why are there so many people who, especially in this moment, push back on information and who don't take that last step of learning?
You know, my feeling is personally that people, you know, because people ask me that a lot, like, oh, no one wants to know facts anymore. People don't believe facts and they don't trust them and stuff like that. But I kind of think that that's not true in every part of people's lives. You know, when people are that way about things where they, you know, they don't want to learn or they're not open to new ideas or et cetera, it tends to be like siloed in a certain specific set of issues. But those people still like learning in general. So one of our goals on the show is we, for the most part, avoid culture war topics or like, you know, partisan topics that are in this sort of like partisan like trough of like, it's almost like a black hole. You know, once you start circling it, if you look.
You say that, but also you did do an episode that was like a border or a wall will not prevent immigration.
Sure, sure. And that was one that was interesting to us because we were like, well, we think the entire, you know, talking to people who actually know about immigration, the entire conversation is misunderstanding certain facts. You know?
Yeah.
So we do those on occasion, but, you know, our main goal is to try to sort of like enliven everybody who's watching with, you know, information and get them more in that habit and get them thinking critically in that way more often, you know. So that's my sort of optimistic take on, you know, the most, you know, the sort of like angriest, most closed off person, you can usually find some way to speak to them in a way that'll like speak to their better self and like get them thinking and learning and interested in asking questions. And so that's one of the things we try to do.
Cool.
Yeah.
I guess the thing for me that like connects us back to Dark Souls here is that when I think about the way, one, Dark Souls for me is like a game about learning things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Like that's the appeal for me of Dark Souls and Bloodborne.
Yes. 100%.
The appeal, actually, slow down. I think for me, maybe, the appeal of video games is learning something.
Yeah.
I totally
agree. Wrapping my head around
the
system.
I'm, in fact, the way I play any game almost, I realized in terms of competitive games like, say, an Overwatch or like an RTS or even like a board game like, you know, Settlers of Catan or something like that, is I really love learning how the game works. And I like learning what the best strategy is more than I like actually executing it. And so once I know what it is, I don't want to play Settlers of Catan anymore because I feel like I know all of the strategies that one could choose.
Yes. Yeah, this is a piece that I wrote this week. Was like, why am I done playing so many games this year, even though they're so good, or like, they're good on paper. Yeah. I think that, like,
you've exhausted what's in them.
I've exhausted, even though I'm only at hour 5 or something. I'm like, oh yeah, I get it.
There's nothing more to
learn. I enjoy it. Yeah. I'm moving on.
And the Dark Souls games have an almost limitless amount of that stuff. Like, there's, you know.
Yeah, they're like cut into like, okay, I've learned how this moveset works for this weapon. I'm going to get a new weapon and learn the moveset there. And then I'm going to go to a new area, and that's going to have some little mini mechanic. I mean, like, this is even some of why you love platformers, right?
Yeah.
Is that, like, the Mario games, like, often will be like, okay, here's the mechanic for this set of levels, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And they'll introduce new things. And obviously, they're so good at level design and mechanics design and the way it interacts. And that's the other part of the puzzle that not every game actually gets to. Like, they might actually have some great systems design. They might actually have some great mechanics. But it might not actually be, you know, presented in the right way in terms of, like, brilliant level design that actually really encourages you to engage with every part of the mechanics, et cetera, et cetera. I know I'm going off into my mechanics
design. This is what we're here for, to some degree. But, like, so this is why I wrote that thing years ago about Dark Souls was, like, at the time, the discourse, largely because of a marketing push, largely because it was, like, the Prepare to Die edition came out on PC, but also just because the fandom was like, this is the hardest game ever. This is the hardest thing ever. It's you versus the world. And, like, that even continues to today. There was that great thread earlier this year by a game developer who asked other game developers to share the way that they kind of tricked the player.
Yeah, I saw that thread. That was awesome.
It was awesome. Like, things like your last little bit of health is actually bigger than you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, the final bullet in the clip and you're in a shooter does more damage. That way it always feels like you're closing off on something more powerful. Or the first shots in BioShock miss you. And there was a commenter somewhere on the internet who was like, if I learn Dark Souls as any of this bullshit, I'm done. And I was like, chill. Like, Dark Souls, of course Dark Souls does that bullshit. There's a symbol you can touch that, like, lets you summon up somebody else. Or there's an entire community of people sharing information about how to beat bosses, about how to solve obscure quests. And so we have this, like, we had this, like, quick and dirty understanding of what was fair and hard about Dark Souls. And we never engaged with the conversation about how actually it's a game that makes itself easier by connecting you to other players through messages, through its design, requiring you to talk about what poises or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm glad, thank you for letting me talk about Dark Souls, because I only started playing it like this year. I played it, like, when it came out, I, like, got a free copy. I was working at College Humor, and I brought it home, and I think the second time the asylum demon attacks you, I was like, what the fuck is this? No. And then after 4 years of hearing about it, I was like, okay, let me actually play it. And I was playing it while we were shooting the show, which is, like, you know, I'm working, like, 80-hour weeks.
Right.
And it turned out to be the perfect thing for me to play while we were shooting, because it was, like, just 2 hours of really intense video games. I can't think about work, you know, like, it's totally consuming and sort of, like, takes me out of, you know, the world I was in to a really strong degree. But I also, I just really, really fell in love with it. And I think a lot of it is because that process of, you know, learning, and it's a gameplay loop of learning, right?
Yeah.
It's like you find your bonfire. Oh, thank God I found my bonfire.
Right.
Okay, I got to step out. Okay, what's through this space, you know? And okay, there's a guy in there. I got to figure out how to deal with this little bit of three enemies. And then now I know how to do that. I can push a little bit further and find the next bonfire.
What was the experience like of you starting to understand that part of the game after years of play, or after earlier in your life seeing it and being like, no, not for me? Like, how did you learn, oh, that's what this game is?
I'm trying to think. Did I there was something. Oh, you know, well, first of all, a weird thing that happened was I played Dead Cells I just had the sense, I was like, Dead Cells seems a little bit like Dark Souls. I knew that there was there were some influences there, and I was enjoying the combat and learning how to use the various moves and stuff like that. And I was like, I just had this sense of, like, I think I might be ready for Dark Souls. Like, I just had this sense in my heart. And, you know, I'd probably, like, read an essay here and there about, like, how it works and everything, you know. And I had also, you know, really enjoyed playing The Witness the previous year, which was which is very much a game about, like, you know, just sit with it and, like, look at it and keep looking and keep trying and, like, and having a high level of challenge and also a constant level of reward, where you're constantly presenting with new challenges that seem impossible but then open themselves up before you. That, you know, that game was, like, sort of everything I like in games in all these other ways. But so I just sort of had a sense that it would be, like that, and that's what it was.
Yeah, in a much more mechanical way, or not mechanical way, because everything is a mechanic,
sure,
right?
Sure,
but
sure.
In terms of dexterity, like actual physical dexterity, it is very interesting. The way I got through Bloodborne, Bloodborne was my first Souls.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I'm working on that right now.
Oh, yeah, I love it. I prefer it to Dark Souls. Yeah. And I played a fair amount of Dark Souls. I played 60 hours-ish of 3.
Oh, jeez,
so,
yeah.
But I got through Bloodborne. Like,
yeah.
Partially because of the theme. It's just so much more fun. That, like, gothic Ed Hardy.
See, I prefer the Dark Souls world by a lot.
Yeah?
But,
all right.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
I'm
only halfway through Bloodborne, but there seems to be a lot more. I like the higher level of, like, environmental differences.
Yeah,
like,
that's a huge absolutely. Part for me. Yeah.
Like, the
yeah.
different, you know, going into, like, the Dark Root Basin, yeah. like, where it's like, wait, what is this now, you know?
The first half of Bloodborne, especially, is just, like, you're in Yharnam, and, like, it looks like this one place. It looks
yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's like, gothic horror.
I've seen more variation since then, yeah. but, yeah, it's very much like, okay, there's, like, spindrels and spandrels, yeah. like, everywhere, and gargoyles.
Spindrels and spandrels! Yeah. I know! Oh, my God.
The two. I took architecture.
I was trying to move past the spindrel-spandrel binary.
You know,
there's a lot yeah. of room between a spindrel
things.
And spandrel.
Yeah. It's a whole spectrum. Yeah.
But Bloodborne is certainly... Bloodborne certainly feels like the 2.0, like,
right.
okay, everything. You know, there's a lot of stuff in Dark Souls.
They learned,
like,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
They're learning from us.
Yeah. But yeah, I just remember the first time I went through, like, the undead burg, and I was like, oh, this is the loop. Like,
right.
I just sort of got with the shortcuts and things. And then Bloodborne is very good at... Like, the shortcuts, there's so many more shortcuts.
Yeah.
And so that loop
yeah.
feels tighter and cleaner and, like, sort of even more rewarding in all these ways. But Dark, you know, the original Dark Souls is, like,
yeah.
sort of this big, crazy, lumbering beast where, you know, I'm, like, more bewitched by it, but it hangs together less, if that makes sense. It's,
sure.
like, a less
yeah.
clear
yeah, yeah.
work. The story that I pitched telling you on the show
oh, yeah.
Also was... just really stuck with me as this specific thing that happened in Dark Souls that I am relatively certain has not happened to many people that really made me think a lot about video games, made me think a lot about the game, had me think for a long time. It's a little bit of a story. What happened was I was in Anne Orlando, which is about big sort of halfway through.
Yeah. It's like the drop off point for a lot of people.
The game, is it really?
Yeah, the game gets really hard in general there,
yeah.
and then you fight the boss. You fight Ornstein and Smough,
right.
who are just like a really hard combo.
Heard
of
them.
Bosses.
I've heard of them.
They're rough.
Heard those names.
They're very tough bosses,
all
but
right.
it's a very beautiful environment.
It's gorgeous. Okay. Yeah.
But so I was in the part of the game where. You know, I was like, okay, I've mastered a lot of things. I have a lot of stuff. I've got, like, my weapon upgraded. Like, I think I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm feeling a little bit cocky.
Like, you've done the whole meta. You not only have done a lot of little loops. At
yeah.
that point, you've done one full meta loop of, like, all right, not only do I know how to move through an area, not only do
yeah.
I know how to upgrade a single weapon,
yeah.
I now understand that I'm building a character who has
yeah.
certain specialties,
yep.
who has certain ways of dealing with a variety of different, like,
yes.
enemy encounters. And then Orlando shows up and is like, all right, you're ready for this, like,
yeah,
test
I'm
almost.
Maximizing
yes.
my halberds up to plus 10 or whatever
you're
it was.
Ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm, like, doing the boss run, you know, and, like, I've met Ornstein and Smough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, time for me to run back to this boss over and over again. And I was, you know, my plan was to summon, I forget which NPC you can summon to fight them.
God,
but
who is it? Yeah, I also forget.
Might be Solaire.
Could be.
But so anyway, you know, in Dark Souls, for those of you who don't know, in order to summon NPCs or other PCs to help you, have to turn human, you know, and...
Again, if you don't know what that means, video games are weird.
Yeah, it's just a thing. It's
yeah,
like...
you just turn human. That's all.
There's
yeah.
a bit that you flip. You're either human or not human. If you're human, you can summon NPCs.
You have more health,
yeah.
but also...
You can be invaded.
Right. By other player characters
who are
NPCs, but mostly
who
want to
kill
characters.
You on the way. Right.
right.
And so, but... You know, now that kind of sucks, you know, but hey, you're used to it, you know, at that point in the game. And so I turn human and I start running towards the boss. I know how to get there. I get invaded. I'm streaming, by the way. I'm on stream.
Oh.
I get invaded.
Were you getting stream sniped? Do you think someone was on Twitch being like... I'm going to get that motherfucker. I like diamond engagement rings, actually.
That's what it was. It was a diamond executive.
It was a diamond executive.
That's what it was. Every kiss begins with K, motherfucker. That's what it was. It comes in.
I will say, as an aside, in Bloodborne, I have now started having my stream audience join me to fight
that's
bosses.
Awesome. That's the opposite thing.
And that's really fun and nice.
Yeah.
And they're always very good. And then I can just sort of beat the boss whenever I want, because I'll just invite one of them in whenever I'm done.
Do you try it first yourself?
I do try. And there's a couple that I have soloed and beaten. And there's other ones where I'm like, I don't. Let's just keep moving. Yeah, let's just keep moving. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm ready to Ornstein and Smough.
Okay.
I'm ready to Ornstein and Smough. I got all my stuff. I'm ready. I'm going to go take my shot. I get invaded. I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm going to die, but whatever. I'll lose my couple souls. I'll show up back at the thing, at the bonfire. I'll do it again.
Yeah.
What happens? I get invaded by someone named Frank Castle.
The Frank Castle? The Punisher?
That I later realized that's the Punisher's. But yeah, that was their screen name, Frank Castle. What happens then is my screen...
He lost his wife. He loves marriage. You targeted
him. That's what it was.
That's it. Okay, continue.
So I'm running. I get invaded. Oh, no. Okay, it'll be fine. Then my screen immediately fills with fire.
Oh, no.
And then the game seems to start glitching. It starts saying, this weapon is broken. That weapon is broken. That armor has broken. That armor has broken. And then, like... And my character's just sort of going like, like shaking, and shit's weird. I'm like,
What was your character doing?
It was just like, he was like stunlocked in this weird way.
It
was my female character.
This wasn't like they hit you.
There was nobody there, yeah. And then as my character collapses, I sort of see the Red Phantom run by.
Right.
You know? And
like a dance or some bullshit.
Yeah, so I was like, what the fuck? Oh, this person is using, I'm playing on PC. I have no mods installed or anything, right? So I'm like, all right, this person has hacked me for God knows what reason, whatever, right? So I wake up and back at the bonfire, and I realize not only are every single one of my weapons broken, which is what happens when you lose durability, but also I am cursed and poisoned. No, I'm not poisoned. I'm just cursed. And curse is really bad in Dark Souls. It means you're permanently, your health bar is permanently halved unless you have a special item. I was like, this is fucked up. I don't know how this guy did this, whatever. But I'm like, okay, I have the special item. No big deal. So I uncursed myself, and then I was like, okay, I have a couple souls, but I have souls saved up. I'll go to the blacksmith and repair all my weaponry. I don't know how he broke all my weapons, but whatever.
Whatever.
So I go to the blacksmith. There's the giant blacksmith in that area who I hadn't really interacted with yet. I had just, you know, seen him.
Yep.
I get there. My stream is like, oh, man, what a loser. That sucks. Yeah, whatever, man. Just go fix your shit, and then we'll go fight Ornstein and Smough. I get to the blacksmith. The blacksmith is not there.
Oh, no.
And instead, there's a glowing, like, item on the ground, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I go pick it up, and it's the giant's hammer, or the giant blacksmith's hammer. And so what this guy had done was somehow, I don't know how, killed a major NPC in my game, who the blacksmiths, if you don't know, in Dark Souls, are the ones who upgrade your weapons, and each of them are able to upgrade specific weapons.
Right, like to a specific point, or like...
Specific types of weapons.
Yeah.
And so if that character's dead, a whole bunch of the weapon ascension possibilities are now closed to me. There's whole weapon trees I can't get. There's no way to bring him back to life. I'm talking to, like, there's Dark Souls experts in my chat going, like, oh, what can you do? Oh, my God. Like,
You've brought the council of theory crafters together, and they're ready to, like...
I was like, can I hack the save file? And they were like, no, you can't. And, there's nothing you can do. And everyone's just like, everyone was like, in this chat was just, like, stunned. I was stunned. I was like, what do I do now? And, so the mechanic is called invasion.
Right.
It was actually very invasive.
Right. Because it sounds like a violation of the game.
Yeah.
Well, like, I think that kind of sets up one of the interesting things
about
games.
It permanently ruined the game.
In general, which is that one of my favorite things about games in general is that even when they are competitive, they're cooperative, right? Because what we're doing when we compete is saying, all right, like, let's shake hands. We
setting
agree.
On the rules.
These are the rules. We're not going to go outside the rules. Knights move like this. Rooks move like this. I will not rough the passer.
Yeah.
Like, if you get to shoot the ball from behind this line, you also get 3 points. I won't contest that. You get your 3 points. This person did not adhere to those rules.
Yeah, exactly.
And so even though normally they would be a competitor, if they came into your stream and killed you regularly with the weapon that breaks things, like there was a lance or something in Dark Souls 1 that removes durability, that would have been like, fuck you for doing that, but you fucking got me.
That's the constraints of the game.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the second that they step outside of that, And like, this is why I still feel like the magic circle is still kind of a useful construct, even though I don't think it's like, are you familiar with this?
I've heard of this, yes. All right.
That like, it's still a useful construct, even though it's not actually like impermeable. It's right. Like, no, there is a social, there is for us, we do get to say when we're in the games, this is the thing that happens. We do want that experience.
Yeah.
And so to see that fall apart. And it then was, feel like a real invasion in some ways is great.
It was really, it was.
I mean, not great.
Well,
it sounds like it sucked for you.
It was immediately, it sucked, but it was like immediately like really powerful. Like I was like, okay, guys, I guess I'll like, you know, try to fight Ornstein and Smough one more time, and I guess I'll log off my stream, you know.
Did you just dig yourself out of the hole in the long run? Like, what'd you do?
Well, so what happened was I logged off, and then it was like the feeling like stuck with me like the whole day that like I've been working on this thing very hard.
Right.
I've put all this time into it. I am like, I want to beat the game. Like, I have the game has a hold over me where it's not arbitrary. I'm like, I just genuinely want to get to the end. And like, you know, my chat was like, yeah, you can beat the game. You just can't get all these weapons that you could get. You know, like, you can still get to, you know, the plus 15 halberd, but you can't make a fire halberd or whatever. I forget which exact upgrades it was. And so it affected me. And the thought that I had was that, like, I was like, oh, this is, like, something that happens to people in real life, right? Like, in real life, never really happened to me in a huge way, but in real life, like, people suffer invasions in their lives.
Yeah.
People are, you know, like people are mugged, people's homes are broken into, people are assaulted in various ways.
And this week, year has been a lot of conversation around this. Yes.
In ways that they don't have control over and in ways that violate like the rules of the game,
norms of society,
the world that we all live in.
Right.
And I was like, well, what do those people do? Those people, well, they just have to wake up the next day and continue whatever goal that they were set for themselves. And I was like, well, I can beat Dark Souls.
And this is Dark Souls. This is so much smaller than a personal attack, a sexual assault, any of these things that actually...
Yeah.
And so, like, you'll dust yourself off and get back on the
And so that's what I did. And I said, okay, this is part of my, you know, also Dark Souls is this game for a lot of people about overcoming adversity and, like, a battle with oneself. You know, if you read on, like, people's comments about it, they'll be like, Dark Souls taught me how to overcome my own limitations because I, you know, and I've had that same experience with, not with Dark Souls, but other I've had other things, you know.
In life
where I was able to take a lesson from a game world and apply it to say, oh, yes, I can do this in the real world, too. So it actually has that element. And so I was like, okay, this is going to be part of my Dark Souls story that this happened. I'm going to beat the game anyway, despite the fact that this happened.
Yeah, that actually, like, now you've done that, and your version of that is way doper than mine.
Yes, exactly.
Which is, I got the fifth level 15 fire halberd, and then I killed Ornstein and Smough, and like, whatever, I'm good, and I kept playing the game.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, this, okay, cool, now I have this story. I was even, like, that day I was like, if I fucking wrote for Kotaku or Waypoint or something, I would write an essay. But instead, I'll try to do something else with it. So this is me trying to use that story.
There it is. You got it on Waypoint.
Exclusive.
It's beautiful.
It's a great story.
Oh, my God.
That's
really...
But the thing it made me think about was that, like... So one of the things I like about games and that I'm interested in games is that a game can, like, model an experience that you might have in real life, and it can give you an analogous feeling in the game that you can then take elsewhere, you know? So, like, I really liked, you know, one of the things I thought was, like, really cool about Journey, for example, is that Journey, like, you know, follows the hero's journey where they, like, lose their power, and you feel it when that happens. It makes you, you're not just, like, watching Luke Skywalker, you're like, no, my power's gone. Right. What do I do? You have that feeling, right? And there are other games that feel the same way. There's millions of other examples.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, that's what happened to me in this game, right? Like, I was able to, within the magic circle, within the fake little world where nothing matters that much, I was able to get a little taste of what happens to, of how someone who maybe that would happen to in the real world might feel, and like build a little bit of that empathy or learn something more about the world. At least that's what I took out of it.
Yeah.
But it only happened because the game was hacked, right?
Right.
Because someone broke the rules of fairness.
Somebody made it unfair.
Made it unfair.
Whereas normally this is like a very fair thing.
Though,
even agreeing on rules and having all of these sort of constructs around it.
Even inside of the rules, they give you a little bit of that taste, right? Like my friend Brad Shoemaker, I think we're good. I think it was just a little waterfowl.
That's
okay.
Spilled the water.
It was very close to a power outlet, but we're okay.
We're okay.
Nothing's hit.
That could have been an unfair advantage.
Let me tell you. would have been very unfair, Danny.
Exactly.
My friend Brad Shoemaker over at Giant Bomb streamed through all of the first Dark Souls game.
Yeah.
And this maybe even happened in Demon's Souls with him now that I'm thinking about
it. Oh, boy.
And which is like an even more obtuse game. I like Demon's Souls. I like Demon's Souls a lot. But like,
yeah, I'm interested where
somebody,
in trying it.
I forget the name of the weapon. Someone in chat probably knows and is screaming it at us right now. It's like some sort of lance or some sort of spear or some sort of something.
Just call it the Lance of Spear.
The Lance of Spear. I like that. Like that breaks your armor and you're equipped when you get hit by it. And like seeing him, that was happening to him without him knowing it was happening. It was just one of those things where it's like the message pops up and it says like your chest plate broke.
Yeah.
Your sword, your shield broke. And he's like, why are my, what? No, I just repaired it. And like, even inside of the circle, even inside
scraping
of
the spear.
The scraping spear. Thank you very much.
There it is. Thank you. Thank you, chat.
The scraping spear, like, even that smaller version of the thing that happened to you still should, or like in Brad's case, definitely communicated some of that feeling of like,
yeah,
this was, I was just driving to work.
Yep.
Truck came out of nowhere. Like, this is not what I was expected. Like, and now I have to deal with what's happening.
And the curse mechanic does that a little bit too, where like, I was very lucky in the game and like, I just happened to, the first time I went through the area with those little frog basilisk guys, I was just able to one hit kill all of them, and I was never cursed because I like got lucky.
Sucks.
Like, yeah, I would have been fucked. That's giving you a little bit of that taste too.
Well, one of my favorite things too about the thing that the curse is like a great mechanic for it is that in the core, have you only played the first Dark Souls at this point? Are you still working through?
I played the first Dark Souls one playthrough and I'm working on Bloodborne right now.
Okay. So when you get to 2 and 3, curse show back up and they're different. It's a different mechanic, but it still says curse. And so one of the things I do like about Dark Souls as a series is that there are these core rules that shift and change in major ways. Like one of the big ones that goes from Dark Souls to Bloodborne, the one that like I made me not bound, I finished Bloodborne, but like I didn't love it as much, is getting rid of Estus flasks and going to the blood vials. And it's like, I loved the Estus flask. I loved the safety of like, okay, it helped each of those sections be a learning lesson. It was like, okay, I have 6 Estus flasks. Can I get through this in 6 Estus flasks? Whereas in Bloodborne, what always happened for me was that I would get through an area because I had 20 blood vials, get to a boss, like be able to get the shortcut to the boss, and then burn through all those blood vials and have none. And then I couldn't get through the area again because I didn't spend the time to learn the area. I just forced my way through it by having this supply of healing items. And so I didn't find my rhythm with the game as smoothly, basically.
It's balanced so differently.
Or I would learn an area really well and then hit a boss that was like just crushed me and I'd burn through the blood vials and I'd have to go back to a previous area because that area wasn't dropping blood vials.
Yeah. You got to get your farming spots.
Yes, exactly.
Which is like, I don't love that the game, I don't love that there is a little bit of farming in it, but...
still very good.
It's amazing.
It's grown on me over the years, is what I'll say. Like at the time, I was like, I want to be having the experience everyone else is having. Everyone else loves this. I like it, but I'm not in love with it.
I also, I'm not a horror. One of the reasons I didn't like Bloodborne quite as much as I'm not a horror guy at all.
I'm
starting to get a little bit more of a taste from it via playing the game. So I feel like I'm sort of getting the spicy food a little bit. But the thing that the experience made me think about was like, so games, what are they definitionally? One of the things that defines a game is we think that it's fair or that there's rules in a way,
That it has rule sets. I feel like at the very base level, it's something you interact with that has some kind of rule set that determines a general path
of play.
What you're going to be
doing. It organizes play in some way.
It certainly is the case that in contemporary gaming culture, people expect rigorous fairness.
Yes, absolutely.
Like OP-ness is a sin in a competitive game.
Yeah.
What that guy did to me is anathema to most people, right? But it just made me think about like what experiences games could provide that we might be missing because there is that focus on fairness.
Totally. Like I would love to play more games that are open about their asymmetry and are like. Here's the other thing is that games are actually asymmetrical. That they present themselves as fair, they present themselves as balanced, but often like the rules do bend this way or that way, right? Yeah. Like not every game, obviously, but again, like that thread that went around
some
earlier.
Some of those magic tricks aren't actually very fair.
Exactly, some of those magic tricks aren't fair. Yeah. Like,
well, they're designed to give the feeling of fairness more than actual fairness.
You should go find that thread. I'm going to link to it in a story.
Real good.
That really makes me wonder, by the way, because when I was playing Bloodborne, I was like, Are they doing the same trick but for leaving a sliver of health?
I'm almost certain that they mentioned
because that happens so much.
Where you just
where
have like
you,
a little bit left.
That last piece.
Where you're like 1, 2, 3, and then they hit, and then the guy hits you, and you're like, "No, he was still alive. I thought I got him.
Yeah,
I thought
totally.
I got him." Or like, it happens all the time in that game.
XCOM definitely like lies in the player's favor, though. They never lie against you. So it might say you have a 90% chance to hit, but you have a 98% chance to hit because they want to produce the effect of making you feel like
you overcame
I'm not sure.
the odds.
That's
right.
such an
you
interesting
are the hero.
Thing. That's such an interesting thing in game design generally, because there's that effect where people's perception of randomness is different than what the randomness
what real randomness is.
It's the I don't know if other people call it this. I would call it the iTunes shuffle effect, where everyone always you say when the iPod came out, like, why doesn't shuffle work? It always plays two songs by the same artist in a row.
Right.
Whereas if you look at true randomness, true randomness includes
this is the quarter
clusters.
Thing, right. That like if you flip a quarter 1,000 times, the way that you can judge if something is really random is if you run into clusters that make you think that's not random.
If you flip a quarter 100 times, you should expect to have a run of 10 heads.
Of 10
in
heads.
A row,
and if it doesn't like have that, but there's a lot of people see it and they go, this isn't real. Someone picked this.
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen. Like, no, that would super happen.
So then Apple created, I think it was called Smart Shuffle, where it was a shuffle that was weighted to never choose two songs with the same artist in a row, which is mathematically less random, but feels to a human listener genuinely more random.
That's really funny.
And so that's like exactly, I think I read the same thing in respect to like XCOM. It was something about that. It was just about, you know, XCOM says 50%, you know, you have 50% chance of hitting and missing. And it's like people always feel like that's people feel like it's unfair, you know,
if it's a 75% chance to hit, 25% chance to miss is huge. Like for me, I always like to like go into different like experiences and say, assign 25% to this other thing or assign any percentage to another part of your life and see how it feels. Like, what if your car only worked 75% of the time? Or what if there was a 1% chance that when you get in your car, it blows up?
No, that's
1 in 100. That's 1% is huge.
But you see it on the game screen, you're like 75%. Oh, I'm definitely going to hit this guy. And you don't.
Exactly.
You're like, what? And that happens twice in a row and you're like, this game fucking sucks.
This game fucking lying to me. I did the right thing. God damn it. Those are alien
scum. You took the right bet.
Exactly.
You took the right bet.
But sometimes the right bet turns out to still lose. Right. Like the right bet is that you made the right bet 100 times in a row and then you've succeeded over time.
Yeah.
And it's not like that one bet is going to be right each
Numbers
time.
Numbers don't actually make sense to the human brain.
Totally.
That's what this whole thing is really about, right?
I think you're right, though, that Dark Souls, I hadn't thought about that it really does create those moments of perceived unfairness in order to create those feelings. Anyway, just that early thing where you're like in the asylum and you're going up a staircase and they rolled a boulder down on you, which is so funny.
It's so
funny. It made me laugh so hard.
Good.
And it breaks what I have read as like, you know, fundamental game design rules of like, you know, I remember from an old, you know, remember like LucasArts games were like, we'll never kill you in a way that you don't expect. Like that sort of, you know, those sort of notions of fairness that were built up in like the 90s, it like explicitly violates them in order to give you
this other feeling.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I want more games to do that stuff. Like, I like to be surprised in that way. There's stuff that happens in a lot of non-AAA games that do this, of course.
Yes.
Right? Like, I'm sure you know, Danielle, like there are a million little independent games, alt scene games, where you'll have to dig into a file on your computer to complete it and like change the coding.
Or
it will do something to I mean, even like I think maybe the biggest example of this was definitely like Undertale a couple of years ago, which didn't play yet. I just keep remembering you haven't played it.
Half of it, but
you've
yes.
not played Undertale?
I played
Undertale.
She isn't.
Oh, you've not played it.
It's a great game. Yeah. But the end of Undertale like does that stuff around what the player expectation of where the game ends and begins is. And it does it in a way that's really powerful and like and clever and like almost obvious. Is I love it when art in general goes like, nice.
You
figured this out. Of course, like no one's done this thing. This is clever. You did it, and it does that like a lot. Towards the end of that game.
Those twists in that game are like mind. But I still haven't even like wrapped my head around all the things that game does. Like
a lot. Well, yeah. I need to spend more time with it to like see if there's something else I want to say about it one day. But also based on where I left the game, I don't want to get spoilery. But like I never want to go back to that world again. I left it in a place where I'm happy with it.
It really has you invested in it.
Yeah, and like I feel like going back to it would almost be a betrayal.
Yeah.
Again, without getting into why I feel that way.
Yeah.
But like that.
I did when with that game. I knew I just knew about a pacifist ending, and so the, my first playthrough, I managed to play perfectly pacifist.
Right.
And
right.
so I think I missed out a little bit
totally.
On the true experience
totally.
Of doing it twice. And then I've read about the genocide ending, which, or I've just read about like what the game puts you through, and
yeah.
I think it's so funny.
It's so,
to have
it's
a game
so
that'd be
much.
Like, oh, you want to see all the content,
yeah.
asshole.
Yeah,
you're
totally.
Gonna do this just so you can
totally.
See content.
Well, that had always
wow.
been my thing with that game,
yeah.
and games in general, which were like, it always, but that sort of, I get the impulse, like I want to see everything
mm-hmm.
because
yeah.
I spent $60 on this thing, and because there's jokes in here, and I want to laugh at the jokes. Show me the
see
jokes, but. Like
speaking
when the message of the game,
yeah.
Well, the message of the game was like, "Hey, no, like the world is the world. You don't get to boil it down to like content for you to consume."
Yeah,
absolutely.
So yeah, that's I think that's our Dark Souls and Undertale talk.
Yeah.
It is.
We should actually take
so.
A quick
ad break.
Yes,
there's
oh, gonna
yeah. be an ad here.
There might be an ad here. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. There might not be a break. There
might
not be an ad.
We'll
who knows?
Try.
10 years from now,
we'll
maybe
try.
There will be no ads in any podcast. They'll all be removed.
A beautiful world.
Anyway,
okay.
But
thanks to our sponsors. So let's take a
get
quick
ready
break.
To hear about Google Home. Here it is.
Yep.
Oh no! Wait. I might have been perceived as plugging Google Home.
No.
I'm not personally plugging Google
Uh-oh.
Home.
Okay. No, just this podcast
right.
is.
Take a break.
We're gonna make a hard pivot now. Are you ready?
Yeah,
are you ready after
it.
That
let's
break? You had a break. You could breathe. Think about the world we want to live in,
do
and
I
then the world
think
that
about
we do live in.
Oh,
so
I
that's
see.
Where we went with this.
Oh.
So Adam, here you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're a comedian. You're in the community.
Oh boy, I really picked a day to be.
You
did.
Picked a day. You picked a day. So this is coming off on the Louis C.K. allegations,
right.
and he had just made a statement just before
Can you, like,
we started recording.
Summarize for people who are maybe
very,
not following
very
along.
Very broadly, they're you know sort of following along a lot of the things about men in Hollywood who have abused their power,
mm-hmm.
and sexually had misconduct, abuse,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of allegations. Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, et cetera, et cetera. Louis C.K. a piece dropped, I believe it was New York Times. Accusing Louis C.K. of masturbating in front of young women.
Five,
basically.
Five,
five
women
I think, yes.
From the comedy scene.
Up and coming comedians in general.
It
I
was,
believe.
Yeah, it was. I don't remember how many of them were comedians,
sure.
but the majority
but
were active comedians.
Which yeah. adds into the power struggle of this. If you're
yeah.
up and coming in a world, he's obviously a very successful person who has, you know, launched so many careers and
mm-hmm.
done so many things like this. So that is relevant to sort of the conversation. And he just released a statement, again, right before we started
yeah.
here, basically saying, tell me if I'm misconstruing this, but really, really to wrap it up, that a lot of these allegations were true.
Right.
That he is saying, yes,
it was
this
very
did
much
happen.
Like, this is
yeah.
true. I abused the power that I was in. I didn't recognize it, blah, 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 blah. Like, I'm not going to
yeah.
say a statement. It's not my job to
right,
defend
right. We're
yeah.
not, we're not giving him
voice,
the
right.
platform
yeah.
here.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's like, it's, I guess it's a good statement, but how good can a statement be? Like,
yeah.
you know what I
right.
mean? So
right.
I'm not like, all right, hey, he said his thing, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah.
right.
Like, all right, off the hook. Like, he doesn't feel that way either, so.
Sure.
And you,
right.
and you tweeted
right.
the other day also, before even the statement, but about the allegations, about the importance of sort of voting with your dollar in certain ways and
yeah.
who to support and who not to support and trying to kind of find the best path
right.
through this mess right now,
yeah.
right? So,
well, it was, you know, so the thing about this is that it's been burning for a long time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's been, you know, the idea of Louis C.K. masturbating in front of female comedians has been like a rumor for a very long time,
yeah.
right? But the problem is it always had a really weird status because it wasn't like the Bill Cosby rumors where it was like, well, there have been settlements. There have been women who went on the record and accused him, like,
mm-hmm.
in the press. You know what I mean? It was always like, well, there's this gawker blind item
right.
that's like that there are no names in. And then when the person went and talked to the people, they said, no, it didn't happen. We don't want to talk about it. And
right.
and like I was like, as a comedian, I'm like, I'm, you know, people. It's like you are hearing rumors about the fact that there are rumors. I was never in a position where someone said this happened to my friend
right.
or that it got. Like
or
that
this
at
happened
all?
To me, to you,
yeah.
went to you and said
how do we address
yeah, exactly.
this, though? Because part of the problem here is that the women who only will come forward, you know, anonymously, or who their stories get told to people on, you know, maybe not on their behalf, but privately, that then wind up in a gossip column or in a rumor column, or when those allegations come through, just filtered down to like, okay, there's no names attached, but here's what's been said. Part of the reason that happens is because the power dynamic puts them,
exactly,
marks them as targets, and so. You know, it's a question we keep coming back to this year. It's a question that didn't start this year, but it's a problem that didn't start this year by any means. But there's an increased focus on it this year, thankfully. Like, people are talking about it in a way that I'm happy that people
appear
are being
to be taking it seriously,
pulled into
at least
the light.
More seriously than
exactly
in previous times.
Like, how
so.
Do
oh,
we?
Yeah,
and this
lot.
Is not just a question. This is a question for Danielle. It's a question
right.
for you. It's a question for the
everybody
audience.
Everybody in the world.
Like, how yeah. do we make it so that? So what do we do when those – like going forward, what do we do when those allegations come out and they are not – they are anonymous? They do not have – like they don't have the power that the press puts on naming names, right?
Right.
And then two, like how do we know – how do we make it so that the people who right now feel like they cannot come out and make allegations publicly, or like how do we make it so that those allegations are handled seriously, taken seriously regardless of anonymity? And how do we make it so that those people who do want to come forward are protected and can feel safe when they make those allegations?
I think – this is – it's a personal topic to me. Look, this is a problem in every industry,
absolutely.
Right?
But, absolutely.
I know.
Like, it's clearly everywhere it's happening. But, this is my industry and, I'm, sort of personally upset that, like, this was something that was, like, happening to, comedians who are people mm-hmm. that – or people
in the,
my
the space
peer
that
group.
You,
yeah, right. exactly. Yeah. And the part about it that makes me the most sick is that, the sort of like protection of Louis that was happening was yeah. very much like comics protecting their own.
Closing ranks.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And like, on the one hand, I understand why people have that reaction. You know what I mean? It's like a human way to feel about people who are in your group, but it's like the people who were being harmed were also comics,
absolutely.
And they
right.
were not being protected, and they were the ones who
right.
needed to be protected.
Who are you closing ranks for?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you could have closed ranks around the victims of harassment, the victims of this misconduct, and instead you closed ranks around the guy
yeah.
who has power.
I mean,
and that's
two,
not you, but
yeah.
you know what
right,
I mean? People
right,
yeah.
did.
Yeah.
You know?
And the two two women who came for the sort of central mm-hmm. interviewees in the
New
not
York
that
Times
anyone's
piece.
Yeah
right.
In the New York Times piece were they did a from what I've heard very great show at the Aspen
right.
Comedy Festival that year and like had great career prospects and then this happened to them and then they were basically had sort of soft pressure retribution
right.
in
yeah.
And it affected their careers that was close to 20 years ago that happened and like I'm like that is the worst like I don't want to this is my industry that this is happening in mm-hmm. So I'm very invested in addressing that as much as we can. I think that the fact that so many people are coming out in all industries and especially the entertainment industry is such a good thing because it reduces the barrier for other people coming out. Both because look, when here's the great thing. When the story came out about Louis, HBO immediately pulled all
yeah.
of his specials off of HBO, right? When the Kevin Spacey thing came out, I mean, between Netflix and the Ridley Scott movie that's being shot, I don't know how many millions of dollars are being spent
right.
or are being set on fire
right.
Because of this. So, it's like now, finally, the main – and this is in a world where – when Woody Allen's
yeah.
daughter wrote a New York Times op-ed,
sucks. Yeah.
An
yeah.
op, like,
yeah.
she
said, hey, here's what
personal
happens.
Account,
yep.
I am writing this,
yep.
it's printed in a newspaper,
yep.
that it will be delivered to the apartments of everybody,
yep.
That Woody Allen's still making movies and people are putting money behind him. So that is a huge change. And so that'll, I think, A, will affect the behavior of, men in Hollywood and B, makes it clear that, there'll be action taken. The
right.
other thing is I think it was a Malcolm Gladwell piece in the New Yorker. It was just about the fact that he was talking about school shootings. It was just about the fact that when you see a behavior modeled a lot, it reduces the sort of like cognitive barrier to take that behavior. So he was talking about how when school shooters are like in the news all the time, it makes it seem more plausible.
Seems normalized.
Yeah, normalizes it. Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, oh yeah, maybe I will. You know. And so
I hope not. But I mean, I know what you're saying.
But this,
exactly.
And so it's the it's the same thing here where I just see more people, feeling like, telling these stories is something that you do.
Right.
Like, that is just, we're in the beginning stages of that. And I'm trying to,
I think
we all try to cultivate that.
Right, well, that's the thing. It's like, it has to be an act of cultivation because otherwise, the story that comes forward is, men in power, people in power can abuse other people and get away with it. If you're in power, you can get away with it. This is like the Roy Moore defenses that are going around over the last day of like, she was 14, but Mary was 14. I don't know. Did you see this defense?
Yeah.
Roy Moore sexually harassing a woman outside of a courthouse. And one of the defenders, people who were defending that action, were saying like, when Joseph and Mary got together to have Jesus, or not have Jesus, but when Jesus happened,
Jesus.
Joseph wasn't involved, of course, in the story as it goes. Mary was 14.
She was like an old lady at that point.
14.
When the life expectancy
also,
is like.
But also,
20.
She didn't have sex with
him. That's the whole story, is that she didn't have sex with him.
She didn't touch him.
That's the whole story.
Yeah, after they were like, man
so
and wife.
She had sex with God, and he's like infinity years old.
Right, he could be whatever age.
He's zero.
This is actually falling apart now. But what I'm saying is that like it's important that I'm so happy that there are so many voices who are speaking out and who are supporting the women who are making these allegations and are standing by them, because that helps shift it in that direction instead of the direction where, frankly, where like it felt like Cosby was pushing things, where Woody Allen was pushing things, where it was like, this is just it. You keep doing those things. Go ahead. Or we can broaden that out, right? Which is like, this is why I'm so terrified of what happens when like black folks get killed in the street.
Mm-hmm.
Is like, nothing happens to the police. And the lesson there is
they get away with it.
Get away
every
with
time.
It. Don't worry about it. Like it's, if it happens, it happens. We'll take care of you.
Yeah, there's no risk. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. I definitely hope that this is a thing that helps push the.
I also think, just to raise your point, to get to your point of like, what do we do with the rumor level, I really think the publication of the story was the important part here, because like, again, with Cosby, it was like all the information was out there, and Hannibal Buress, someone taped him in the back of a show. That was bizarre. I was actually like trying to like do some material on that at like in my own comedy at the time, and like I felt like Buress got out in front of it. I was like, now this is a story, because we had a little joke in an Adam Ruins Everything thing about how like this is true and nobody talks about it, because it was like there was like on the record like well reported stuff, and it just wasn't. People weren't publicly aware of it until, for whatever reason, Hannibal Buress' thing goes viral.
Right.
The difference with Louis, like, I looked at it a lot. I had a lot of conversations with comics about it, and it was really this thing of, like, everyone has heard about the existence of rumors. Again, I was not, if you were at Aspen in 2002, you probably heard the rumor directly,
right?
But I was not. I don't know any of that. And then all of the published pieces were, like, by a reporter who was like, I've heard of this rumor. And I went and I've tried to find information on it, and I have found nothing, and there's no names, and there's no, and there were not actually allegations made, right? It was like a cloud, So as far as like, how differently should I feel about Louis C.K.? I was like, I believe he's a creep and he's done some shit, but I don't have a reason to,
take that second step.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so what the second step that needed to be taken was reporting, and that was what was actually done. I don't think that I would not advocate for like, people's HBO specials to be pulled because of rumors. Right. Because I would think that would be like a step that, a rumor is
something
we should.
Because like the thing is that like when you I think that's an easy thing to I think that that would be. I want that because it's clean and like it's simple. And like, yes, if at the state of rumor before there's an actual article published, I would just withhold judgment until there's better reporting done. But then the second I start thinking about why reporting doesn't get done, the structural causes for the difficulties to report on something like that, especially today in the age of Peter Thiel, in the age of like the risk of being sued into the fucking ground. The reason that people don't come forward and don't want to talk about it because of the risks to their careers. Like, to some degree, the reason that these women were willing to now come forward with these allegations is it was so long ago that their careers were not as in an imminent danger as they once were. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so like all those reasons make me... I don't have an answer. This isn't me saying, like, and therefore trust every rumor. But I do want to complicate that notion because I don't think that we can so easily.
There's also the aspect of this where I think culturally a lot of times women don't get listened to with regards to this. There is always that the aspect of, oh, she's doing this to bring down a powerful man. Right. There's always that like very sexist, very misogynist, like Archie Bunker in the room kind of thing where it's like, nah, she's just talking, or whatever. Instead of like actually taking it seriously, because oftentimes, not always, of course, I know you have to say this, but oftentimes women aren't making this shit up. Like, a bad thing probably happened. So it is worth looking into more. And of course, that's where we come into that gray area of treating a victim or a survivor with respect, respecting their wishes, not, you know, kind of doing anything else with that. But trying to find the right way forward when things are a mess.
Maybe, for me, the easiest takeaway, or the one that most appeals to me as someone who's in this space is like the corniest, like, if you see something, say something, right? Which is like when you hear that rumor, go to somebody who is their job to then investigate that. Try to put people in contact with people who can support them, who can tell their story, it's not up to you to be a detective, but it can be you. You can be the person who can put them in contact with someone who can do that work. And like, instead of it just being, because like the other thing that happens is an allegation will come out, but then it will, by the time it shuffles out, is just a rumor, right? Like, someone will allege something privately to somebody and then like, okay, well, yeah, I heard some things. And that, like, that that original allegation, which is not made in the broad public, but then just comes out as like someone along the line, someone in the game of telephone, shifts it from being, this is the thing I heard happened, to I heard some stuff happened. And once it becomes that, that gets published instead. And that's tough.
I think that, you know, in response to what you said about, the reasons the reporting doesn't get done, and the reasons the women don't come out, like, I think the thing that we have to do is to continue to work to reduce those systemic barriers, you know, and which I think is like, thankfully seems to be happening to, you know, to some extent, like in the present moment. And like, people are, you know, there's been a huge shift in awareness at any rate. So like, in terms of like, yeah, exactly what you're saying, like bringing the existence of the rumor to people who can do something about it, you know, because that's the whole problem, right? For me, as someone in comedy, look, I don't interact with Louis C.K. I have no in my business, I don't have a reason to, right? But even if I had been in that position, right, two weeks ago or a year ago, you know, I would have been like, man, I have heard so little, though. You know, there's so little that's actionable, right? And so that's the problem. And so the point is, so like, rather than focus on like that specific, you know, thing, the point is to like, you know, make those not die in the rumor stage, like create a fertile ground for these, you know, stories to come out more. 'Cause man, it really is horrific.
Absolutely. And I just to close up, because I know we got to close up shop real quick. We could talk about this all day. Not just this, obviously.
We can talk about all kinds of stuff. Can I just make one really quick plug?
Please, absolutely.
Because a really great comic named Megan Keister she did this for Vice, I believe. She went to JFL, the huge comedy festival, for a couple years ago, and did this incredibly ballsy thing. She wrote about it, I think, twice for Vice, where she went to the red carpet line and started asking comedians, what do you think about the Bill Cosby allegations? They said, oh, terrible, terrible. Asking like Kevin Hart and shit. And then she was like, what do you think about the Louis C.K. allegations? And they would go, and then they would walk off. And then she was kicked out by like the VP of the festival or something, who came up and yelled at her and said, Louis is family, you don't do that here. And
you don't
like,
do it when it's family. You don't call people out when it's family.
Yeah, and it's always family that did it. That's the other thing. It's always family that does it.
And like, I don't think that is how you report a story like that, but I do think it is an incredible
piece of like work to
that's incredible, a piece of performance art there to actually show that. Kind of
awesome. And so there's a place for spectacle in these things.
Go check out that piece and go check it. She's really funny too.
One more time, name
Megan Keister.
K-E-I?
K-O-E-S-T-E-R.
There we go. Keister. Awesome.
Yes. And also shout outs, as always, whenever we talk about any of these issues, I always want to shout out RAIN.
Yep.
People, you know, have had a problem, have an issue. It's the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. They do a lot of work as well with the fringes of this as well, as sexual misconduct and all that sort of stuff. So if you need a resource, that's kind of a good go-to.
Yeah.
And also, as always, I think it's great for people who have some degree of power, who have some degree of sway, some kind of platform to speak out about these things, because that does show, that sort of does signal that you give a shit and that you want to actually foster a better world in your own industry or your own little corner of the world.
In your own corner of the world, yeah.
So I know, sorry to rush through the outro. I know it's a very exciting conversation. I just have to go to a very important meeting, which is, you know, all these meetings happen. I'm sure you understand meetings.
Oh, God.
What are you doing in New York? Is there anything
I'm here for the New York Comedy Festival. Right. I'm doing a big show at the Gramercy Theater Saturday night I forget what time, but it's at the Gramercy Theater.
We'll look
it up. See it there. And
awesome.
Yeah. And people can follow you on Twitter.
Follow me at Twitter at Adam Conover or on Twitch also at Adam Conover.
You play some Bloodborne.
Watch me play some
Bloodborne. Or some Mario Odyssey.
Killed by some werewolves, yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, killed by some blood beasts and all kinds of things. That sounds pretty good. That sounds fun. Austin, where can people find
you? _Walker on Twitter. Very easy.
Amazing. And if you have questions, maybe we'll do a question on Twitter or something after this, but send questions to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shout outs, of course, to Bowen, letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Thank you, Rob Schulte. Thank you, Natalie Watson, for producing and also producing. You're both producing beautifully. I appreciate it. Waypoint, we are Waypoint on Twitter.
Yes.
And on Facebook, we are Waypoint Vice. I always get it confused. I don't know why.
We'll
and, of course, on YouTube, we are Waypoint Vice. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you so much,
Adam.
Thank you so
really
much
for
appreciate it. Anytime you're in town, please let us know.
I would love to.
Come over,
I would love to come
hang
back.
Out with us.
Might work
we won't always talk about serious things. We can talk about all kinds of stuff.
If you want to hear us hang out more with Adam, go to our Twitch right now, twitch.tv/waypoint, or to our YouTube in the next couple of days, and you'll be able to see us play a trivia game.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power for the PS4, so go check that out.
Very on brand.
Very on brand.
Very much on my brand.
Awesome. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
I'm going to always say, be good and be good at it.
Peace.